Hey friends, I'm Larry Kirk, and this is The Music and the Dance, and that's a podcast about God and the gospel and our everyday lives. It's also a metaphor. It's an analogy in which the gospel, the rich message of God's redemptive love in Christ and all of its implications of grace for us, that's the music. The life that we're to live as an expression of that gospel's power in our lives, that's the dance. The gospel empowers and inspires the life. And if you're not dancing well, sometimes the thing that needs to be addressed is not just, you know, that you look at your feet more carefully and focus on getting the steps right, but that you turn up the music and really allow the sweet strength and beauty of the message of God's redemption in Christ to have an impact on your heart and then your life. Out of the depths of the heart flow the issues of life. Well, I'm joined today in all of this discussion, this theme that we've been on for some time now, with my friend Peter Fiore. Peter is a pastoral assistant at Christ Community Church, where I'm the lead pastor. And we've been into this book called The Dynamics of Spiritual Life by Richard Lovelace. Subtitle is An Evangelical Theology of Renewal. And we've come to this chapter titled The Evangelical Muse, M-U-S-E. The idea is, well, let me ask Peter, what would you say is the key idea of this chapter in Lovelace?
You know, it's going to sound trite, but really this idea of Christian art and the future of Christian art from his vantage point in the 1970s, but also the current state of Christian art.
Right.
You know, it's interesting that you mention the music and the dance. You know, the music is... Dance is beautiful. It's music and movement together.
Yeah.
It's beautiful. And so it's funny, we come to a chapter which is really about beauty and about art and about the possibility of making artistic expressions that glorify God and that move people to love Christ and his church.
Right. And I think the reason we might ask the question, why does Lovelace include a chapter on evangelicalism and the arts in a book that's devoted to the dynamics of spiritual life, begins talking about Jonathan Edwards and the Jesus movement, traces evangelical renewal and revival movements throughout history, talks about the kind of core elements in revival, the preconditions, the primary elements, the secondary elements, and then suddenly here's a chapter about the arts, right?
Yeah.
And so it's really interesting. But I think what he's saying is, out of the overflow of the heart, the mouth speaks. That's me paraphrasing something Jesus said. But it's also true that out of the abundance of the heart flow the issues of life. That if the heart is gripped by the grace of God, because we're creating the image of a creative God, there will be a creative expression and not just a character or moral expression of the beauty.
Yeah, and I think he's also writing at a really interesting time.
Right.
A lot happening.
Yeah.
You know, music is exploding with all these new artistic expressions.
Right.
You know, there's the new Hollywood movement. Film is not just taking off, but it's changing. Things are happening in the culture. There's a younger generation that is at times at odds with the older generation about what forms are appropriate or interesting.
Right.
Or so there's just a lot going on, and I think he sees this, and art in the context of culture, in the context of Christianity, as a really vital issue.
Huh. Yeah. It's so interesting. He begins with a pretty in-depth, long story about his own journey from, as he would put it, like a classical snob. he was really into traditional classical.
Yes.
I forget what word he used to describe it, but he had a different word for it than classical music. Serious music.
Serious music.
He called it. Yeah.
Yeah.
As if all serious music is classical music.
Yeah.
And he even struggled to accept the popular music, even though he was still relatively young. He's like 20 years later. When I say 20 years later, I'm referencing the fact that he said he bought his first album at the age of 14, and I think it was Rachmaninoff. Mm. And then he said 20 years later, he was slowly beginning to think maybe the Beatles might have some merit, because wow. Leonard Bernstein came out and kind of pointed out some of the complexity that might have been overlooked in their music with their melodies and stuff. So I wondered, what about you? What have you had? I know Peter and I both kind of commented that this is a little bit out of our wheelhouse. Mm-hmm. We both have interest in the arts and people that we know and love that are into the arts, but we are not, either of us, fine artists.
Yeah.
We don't play an instrument. I don't sculpt or paint or write poetry. So I wondered, though, just about your own journey of faith and art. How does that work out?
It's interesting because I'm a huge film guy. I love movies. I've loved film since I was very young, maybe around 12 or 13. And from a very young age, and even till now, it's been a real struggle to really find, and it's been a journey to discover authentic pieces of Christian artistic expression. And you know, growing up, I was homeschooled in a pretty conservative context, and you know, we'd watch Christian media, Christian movies, and they're just so, you know, they're hokey, and you know, oftentimes, you know, I don't
want to offend somebody. Do you remember any particular Christian movies?
I mean, I just remember watching, like, Facing the Giants, right? And it's, like, not overtly, like, prosperity gospel. It's not like that's, like, the point of the movie. Right. But there is this kind of sense of, like, well, if you pray to Jesus, things will work out for you. Your team will win. Your wife will get pregnant. Everything will work out, you know? And I just think it misses some of the kind of more traditional ancient questions that art asks, is of, like, we know one of the big questions, like, why are we suffering? Why is God allowing this? Right. You know, like, those big, deep questions that I think serious art should deal with. I use that word serious, like Lovelace does, right? But anyways, I got involved in you know, as I moved into college, you know, watching a lot of secular film, and that was an awesome experience, and I still enjoy secular art, but there's obviously something really missing, right? There's, you know, the truth of the gospel, the truth of Christ, the truth of a worldview. It's been a rocky journey. Yeah. I'll say that.
Yeah. By the way, if you're listening and you hear some rumbling, ominous sounds in the background, Peter and I are in my office today on a Monday morning, August the 2nd, recording this, and we're in Florida, and in the afternoon in Florida in August, you get these huge thunder boomers and the thunder, God's artwork.
Yeah.
The lightning and thunder is right outside. You may not be able to hear it, but you can imagine it. Yeah, I think for me, it's kind of similar. At first, I mean, I grew up as a young person loving movies, but mostly for escapism. Mm-hmm. I wasn't really thinking, you know, I'm looking for deep reflection mm-hmm. on the issues of life mm-hmm. in art. If mm-hmm. that happened, it was a wonderful surprise, mm-hmm. but I kind of was just like escapism, which was a big theme of my life on multiple levels, you know, substance abuse, adrenaline junkie, and the same way with that. But there's something about art that draws you in, mm. and the more you see that's good, the more you recognize something that's very hard to articulate, you know, what makes something really stand out. Not too long ago, a few years ago, Connie and I went to Edinburgh, Scotland, and one of the things we did is we went to the Museum of Fine Art there, mm. and there was one room, and it had all these drawings. They were mostly pencil sketches, and I was just drawn to this one that just stood out in a way that they were all great. I mean, they would not have been in the museum at Edinburgh if they weren't really well done, but I walked over to this one, and it was Rembrandt.
Wow.
And so it's just like I could never articulate why, before I knew who painted that or drew that, it was not even a painting, why did it stand out in this room full of excellent work? But it just did.
Wow.
And it kind of made an impression upon me. But going back to growing up, when I became a Christian, I talked about this a little bit in the chapter on Jesus, on the Jesus movement. There wasn't any contemporary Christian music in particular that was Christian. And so it was very strange because I had a great love for music. I liked music. I listened to music all day, all the time. Music was the soundtrack for my life throughout those years, going back really even to elementary school. My sisters would, every Saturday we would clean house and they'd put on records while we're cleaning house. But I mean, I'm talking about like Buddy Holly and the Crickets, and, you know, really early rock and roll.
Yeah.
And then the British invasion, big debates, almost fist fights in my elementary school over, do you like the Beatles or do you like Elvis still? You know? So all this cultural change, though, you know, that you just get a feel for how this music was so much a part of that time. Even to this day, you know, you watch a Vietnam movie like Apocalypse Now,
Apocalypse
and the
Now.
Soundtrack with The Doors or Jimi Hendrix.
Or Good Morning Vietnam, right? With
it's just so much a part of that era.
Yeah.
So you become a Christian, and it's like all I had that was Christian was gospel music, Southern gospel, which I did not. Somehow it just never did really appeal to me, or really good classical Christian music. The beauty of the really good classical Christian music and hymns is they hold up.
Yeah.
They really do hold up. And one of the first things I remember, I was mowing the lawn one day as a young Christian, and I just kind of felt like it was a waste of time. I wanted to do something meaningful, and I went in and found a hymnal that my parents had. It was a Lutheran hymnal, and so I took it out in the backyard, and I memorized "Come Now, O King Eternal" as I mowed the lawn. You know?
Wow. Wow.
So I would like read, "Come Now, O King Eternal, the day of March has come, henceforth in fields of conquest. Thy tent shall be our home. Through days of preparation, thy grace has made us strong. And now, O King Eternal, we raise our battle song." And I just would be marching with the lawnmower. "Come now, O King Eternal." Yeah. But it's interesting that I would not have done the same thing with, like, you know, like a four-part harmony Southern gospel song. It just did.
Yeah.
But that older hymn that he did. But there was still the longing for music that related more to my culture. So I looked for things that would come out that would not necessarily be purely Christian or even perfectly Christian, but had those themes. And so, like, when the album Blind Faith came out and Eric Clapton did a song, "I Have Finally Found a Way to Live in the Presence of the Lord," there's still debates about whether or not he had had some kind of legitimate Christian conversion experience or not, but there's nothing in the language of that song that you couldn't adopt.
But then
slowly you begin to have more and more Christian music come out, but there was a big pushback for the most part from older Christians.
They weren't
sure that style of music could be redeemed. You know, because it had its roots. You know, it's kind of guilty by association.
Right, right.
The roots of rock and roll go back to a culture, you know, first of all, to, you know, some Afro-pagan, maybe, music, Caribbean and slave music, and then kind of the blues being primarily a genre that even in the African American community was set as apart from the gospel. Mahalia Jackson sings gospel songs. Shirley Caesar sings gospel songs, but Big Mama Thornton sings the blues, you know, and there was a difference, a big difference in the culture between those two. So rock and roll was tainted by those associations and by its more typically having as its theme teenage romance.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
Right.
It's interesting seeing, and we're going to get into the history a little later, but it's interesting seeing, so Lovelace in his chapter charts a lot of prescriptions that he'd like to see happen in the future of over the next few decades, thinking back from the 70s. And it's interesting. The music scene and the fine art scene and the film scene are just very different spaces.
Yeah, they really are.
Because it's an interesting to see how like Christian music has really stepped up this game in the last couple of decades. Right? You know, I can think of, you know, I don't listen to him particularly, but almost all my friends who are really love good music and love Christian music listen to guys like Josh Garrels, you know, Fernando Ortega, Andrew Peterson. You know, there's some of these guys that are really poetic and beautiful, but also, you know, think right out of their faith, write their lyrics out of their faith. Yeah. But it's interesting seeing that in other spaces not really play out.
Right.
You know, I can think of, and you know, you mentioned, this is interesting, Larry, I just kind of want to park here for a second. You know, you mentioned how you were drawn to some artistic expressions that weren't perfectly Christian. Mm-hmm. And there's tension there, mm-hmm. right? And I like to talk about that tension because in one sense you have people saying if something isn't really explicitly, dogmatically, you know, articulating Christian truths, then it's, you know, compromised or something like that. But then there's the other end where I see a lot of artists today kind of vaguely talking about Christian themes, but like not really, but like kind of like using Christian themes, but not really like committing themselves to them. And so I don't know. There's interesting tension there, for me at least.
Can you flesh that out a little bit? Give me an example of what you mean by that. I mean, are you talking about artists that you think maybe are not Christians?
Well, they're vague about it. They're vague about it. And I don't. I'm not saying that's necessarily a wrong thing, but right. I see the. You know, and I'm drawn to that as well at times.
Yeah.
I'm drawn to the mystery and the, not ambiguity is too strong of a word, but like just the poeticness.
Well, and yet ambiguity sometimes is something that we have to live with. You know, just remember a couple weeks ago I did that sermon in Acts where you have in one chapter one of the apostles is being, you know, dramatically delivered from prison by an angelic intervention. The next chapter, another apostle is being martyred.
Mm-hmm.
And you think, okay, if the church is hearing these reports, their expectation of what God will do might, ambiguity might not be
the wrong word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's certainly not everything is tied up. I think this is one of the impulses is the fear in Christian art.
Yeah.
Whether it's visual arts, movies, songs, that if you don't tie things up with a nice bow at the end, if you leave people in the tension of reflecting on things, then it won't be clear. People, you know, won't understand, like you said, with the movie about the, what was it, the giant.
Facing the Giants.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Like everything just kind of works
out.
If
your wife doesn't get pregnant and you don't win the championship,
right,
then it's not clear whether or not it's worth following God.
Lovelace has an interesting quote here where he talks about the problem is the sterilization of art by ascetic moralism and oversimplified theology.
Here's another quote that kind of ties into that.
Yeah.
It's where he's asking for theological creativity. He says, a two-dimensional theological outlook, which divides the human population into the saved and the lost, and then identifies, this is the key, I mean, there are two populations, God's people and those who aren't God's people.
Yeah.
You know, you are a chosen people. It divides them into the saved and the lost, and then identifies those categories with unmixed good and evil.
Mm.
Without sensing the tragic ambiguity of indwelling sin and the mysterious movements of the Holy Spirit in common and special grace.
Wow.
If you can't recognize that, he says, you will not be able to create a literature that rises above black and white caricatures of human experience. So he's saying, on the one hand, let's face it, in Christians, just like in the characters of the Bible, David, Peter, examples, you have the tragic ambiguity of indwelling sin. Yeah. People who really love God and want to serve him, but are flawed humans. And in non-believers, you have people like Gamaliel or Cornelius before Peter visits him, or the mysterious characters like Melchizedek, of all people, you know, in the Old Testament, where something's going on there that you're never totally explained all the dimensions of it, but there's common grace at work in them. And so even in Acts 17, Paul quotes the pagan poets. You know, I love that verse where he says, in him we live and move and have our being, talking about that we are living in the presence of God every day. And he says, as one of your own poets has said. You know? So I think that that's interesting, really interesting. And I think that's one of the points that he wants to make, that if we don't allow for that, we really put a damper on the most creative. There will be people, and this is okay on its own level, people like me, for instance, who's not like, you know, I piddle around on the guitar a little bit, but I'm not like musically gifted, and I'm certainly not deeply, I don't have the competency to even express creativity musically. But I love the Lord, I come to Christ, I want to sing about it, I might write a poem, I might sing out loud, you know, extemporaneously in the woods by myself on a moonlit night to God, and that's all beautiful. And maybe if I'm a little bit more gifted, I can even put together three chords and a chorus and make it a praise song that in my campus ministry everybody loves because I wrote it. You know? You know. But there are going to be real artists who want to express something they themselves can hardly put into words.
So it's so fascinating that you mentioned this, Larry, because, you know, I think back to my own journey. I remember... So there's an artist that I love, that I know you love too, named Terrence Malick.
Terrence Malick. Right? Filmmaker.
And he made a film in 2011 called The Tree of Life, which you know, of course, it won the highest award of film in the world, the Palme d'Or, at the Cannes Film Festival. And, you know, it starts off with a quote from Job. And where are you, O man, when I laid the foundations of the world? You know, and it starts off with this woman losing her son in the Vietnam War, asking, just crying to God, why, right? And then you're taken, it's very interesting, you're taken to the beginning of the universe, and there's like 20-minute scene, like, what is happening to this movie? It's like cells and animals and planets, and it's just microcosms, everything. And then it comes back to the domestic struggles of this family. And it can seem really met, but like it actually, it's fascinating. I won't spoil the film for you, but it actually helped me deal with some really big questions I had about suffering and about God's sovereignty. You know, it's interesting, at the end of the movie, you see kind of the end of time, a bunch of people on a beach, and they're just reconciling. Right?
That's such a beautiful movie.
It's a beautiful movie.
Listeners, if you haven't seen The Tree of Life by Terrence Malick, one way to understand kind of what we're talking about in this whole episode is go put yourself in the frame of mind where you're going to let this movie speak to you, and you're not going to get impatient. If there are sections of the movie where you're not sure where it's headed at all, you can't anticipate the storyline, but you just have to kind of surrender to the message. And it will leave you with images that are absolutely, I believe, not just beautiful to see, but graciously empowering.
I remember... about a year ago, I realized that, because I had contemplated that last scene for a long time, this people on this beach reconciling, and like you know, and I remember thinking about this idea that I think Malick is trying to portray, is that somehow at the end of human history, when God restores all things, it will somehow, it doesn't solve the problem of evil. It isn't, for us at this moment right now, it's not like we know the reason why we're suffering, but for some reason it was an image of the future that was so beautiful that could sustain present suffering.
It makes you think of that. I can't recreate the quote, but the Dostoevsky quote that Tim Keller has used in the context of suffering, which is also interesting because it comes up in a dialogue in a piece of literary art, fine art, Dostoevsky. In this dialogue, I forget which of his works it's in, but this man says, I believe that in the end, all of the suffering will be like more. What we will see as the final conclusion will more than like answer all of our questions at a deep level and leave us like satisfied.
And that was helpful for me. It's helpful, but it's also like you can say words, but then you can see images. And it can So, you know, that movies like that were really helpful for me, and I think it gets to our to your question and your kind of comment about ambiguity, right? It's not we're not saying, you know, oh well, we're not all saying, you know, low on truth. We're saying we're high on truth, but we also believe that mixed in the truth, are things that we don't understand. I mean, think about the very – and this is what this is something I think all the time, Larry, is that think about at the very center of our faith. At the very center of our faith is this idea that our God is three persons in one, right? One God, three persons. We can't even begin to understand that, right? We could talk about it. There's a lot of beautiful books written about it that try to understand it, right? But like we all agree that like if we really come down to it, we don't understand how it works, but we trust in faith.
Right.
Right? Or this idea that of the two natures of Christ, that he's fully man, fully God. You start thinking about that, your head starts spinning, right? Yeah. And so when I think about at the very center of our faith
are these huge mysteries.
Huge mysteries wrapped in these true statements. That's why we have creeds to articulate what is true,
right?
We should see mystery and all around us.
Yeah.
And I think art and good art should be investigating that.
So art isn't always simply to decorate a place, nor is Christian art going to be necessarily always like the prettiest art in the room.
Mm-hmm.
As if that's always the purpose. Who was that famous writer, painter that a lot of people were really into that did like these beautiful, almost fantasy scenes of like plants and
I'm not sure.
Well, anyway, several years ago, there was a guy who just, you know, really everybody loved his, his work, and it was all, you know, it was kind of beautiful, but it was kind of like fantasy, almost Tolkien-ish, idyllic pictures. So art does, that's not the test of Christian art. What Lovelace keeps coming back to is, does it express, in a sense, a Christian point of view, a Christian worldview? And so there can be non-Christians who, because of common grace, or because they're living on the kind of intellectual, theological estate of God without acknowledging the owner, the master, they're like, you know, camping out on his land, as Van Til, Cornelius Van Til used to say, you know, anybody that's reasoning or doing any art or you know, putting forth any moral agenda is kind of like eating the master's food on the master's estate without acknowledging the master's existence.
Yeah.
Because none of those things have value or meaning apart from presuming the axiom of the Trinity and God. So there are people who, because they bear the image of God, are able to do great art. Then there are also people who, because they're deeply ensnared by the blindness of the fall, can do really hurtful so-called art. In the same way, there are Christians who can do kind of superficial cliche art. And then there are Christians who can really do good art. Now, what Lovelace, I think, is saying is that you would expect where true spiritual renewal takes place, that renewal would reach every aspect of life. And it would not only make the father a better father, the husband a better husband, the businessman a more ethical and caring boss, but it also make the artist a more impassioned and freer artist. But he talks about a problem, a couple problems. And just briefly, I want to touch on these because it's part of the chapter. So one thing is he says, One of the problems, he talks about it with musicians, but I think it's been true of visual arts as well, is that the media is dominated by a power structure controlled by the flesh and the world and ultimately the devil. And then closely connected to that is the capitalistic profit motive.
Yeah, yeah.
And it's interesting, from his time to ours, we've seen a little bit of a shift in that there's like a really marketable Christian market now.
There is.
That you can sell tons of stuff to.
Yeah.
And that actually, the irony that I don't think Lovelace anticipated, is that's a double-edged sword.
It is.
Because now you can get funding for Christian art if it's consumeristically friendly Christian art.
Yeah, like, and this is and this is something I wanted to bring up, is that, like, in my mind, great art provokes and challenges.
And not everybody wants to pay to be provoked.
But, like, if we really take our theology seriously and we really believe that we're as sinful as the Bible says we are, we're as fallen, then we should assume that our lives need to change.
Right.
And we should assume that
right.
we should be willing to let artistic works challenge our assumptions about the world, about how we think about things, how we see people, how we see everything.
Yeah.
You know?
But it's interesting. I heard a recent survey, and I think this – I'm going to try to bring this back around to art. But it was talking about asking even Christian college students who were heading off to certain Christian colleges, institutions, what they were looking for in that experience, in their college years experience. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to give you the kind of the boiled down version.
Yeah.
But like all good surveys, it was done to kind of tease out what people really want. And they compared what people, young people today, were asking of these Christian institutions and what young people were asking several decades ago. And the significant difference was, several decades ago, a significant thought was, I want to be shaped. I want to go to this institution so that this institution and my experience of being on this campus can shape me into a better Christian man or woman. Mm-hmm. And now, it was mostly the language of affirmation, not shaping.
Wow.
I don't want to go to be shaped into something other than I am. But I am going hoping that I will receive the affirmation that I want for my identity as I've identified it myself.
Yeah.
So I think the third thing we would add to
that
would just be escapism.
Yeah.
And so I think when you're marketing, when money becomes the motive, as you have a shift in the culture where fewer people are saying, I want to be provoked, challenged, shaped, more are saying, I want to be affirmed, comforted.
Right. And therefore, we get stuff like God's Not Dead, where we have, you know, a film where, like, there's character of the, you know, the crazy, you know, mean atheist, right? And the good college student who challenges and wins and brings back God to the campus and everything works out.
Now, you're going to get in trouble, because that's probably the favorite movie of, like, a lot of our people. So,
I mean, I know what you're saying. I'm not saying that doesn't have value. I'm simply saying it works to justify
But who's going to do the life story of Rabbi Zacharias right now?
Right.
Because that's going to be a painful.
Yeah.
Even if you did it from a very Christian point of view and tried to acknowledge all the good he did and all the redemptive stuff in the gospel. It doesn't turn out
the way we all want
with the neat storyline.
Yeah.
Now, one thing that's interesting is there's a very popular podcast right now. I know we're going from art to podcast, but it's this theme, is The Fall of Mars Hill.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where people are really, there's been some pushback to some of it. Some of it, but on the whole, I'm hearing that it's just a fascinating, creatively done exploration of the Christian evangelical culture that led to a cult of personality and the crumbling of a church that was at one point a powerhouse. So, but then even with that, maybe I'm cynical, but I start to think, but people will love a story where, you know, the mighty are fallen type of thing. There's kind of a perverse delight in those kinds of stories.
Yeah, there is. It's,
Well, he... we're probably roaming far and wide. Let me just pull this back a little bit. Just quickly, he said, another thing is not only this idea of money. And so what I was trying to say is, you were talking about good art can provoke and challenge us, but if you make money, to the degree that money is essential to free people up to do art and to have the resources and the time to devote, then it pulls you towards consumeristic art that is affirming or pleasing or escapism rather than provoking and challenging. The second thing he said is that people with money in Christian circles are most often middle-aged or older.
Yeah.
And therefore, sometimes they are not sure they see the value of new forms and expressions. They think their art was good enough.
Yeah.
And so they're slow to fund things that might be what's really needed for people today.
Yeah.
And, you know, now it seems like the generational gaps culturally are just as wide as they ever were, but they come far more quickly than they used to come. Now, you know, people are dividing up the generations almost according to decades.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And there's a difference.
Yeah. You know, and he's talking about that issue very much in the context of there need to be increase in financial backing of young artists, but that's hard when there's this cultural divide.
Right. And the older people don't see. Maybe they don't get the irony of a Christian comedian or the messiness of a Christian visual artist who doesn't want to just paint something that's pretty.
You know? Especially when we live in a world that's both beautiful and tragic.
Right.
And so much of, as we've talked about before, good Christian visual art is something that acknowledges that tension between a tragic world and, you know, a world that God is turning.
Yeah.
Making all things new, right?
Yeah. So he talks about one more problem as a hindrance, and that is what he calls the sterilization of art by ascetic moralism and oversimplified theology. I think we've actually already kind of touched on that.
Yeah.
The next section is he talks about the roots of a barren culture. What are the roots of evangelicalism that have led to this lack of appreciation and support for the arts? And I thought he had a couple of interesting things. We'll just kind of briefly touch on these because, you know, there's a lot here and he spends a lot of time on it. But one is, he says, the evangelical roots in Puritanism and Pietism were kind of a reaction against Catholicism and Orthodoxy with their often, you know, very, very high views of what's the word I want to use? Just kind of a deeply sensual, highly symbolic, stained glass windows and incense and vestments that are fancy and all kinds of symbolism, that the sum result of all of that with Puritanism and Pietism was to kind of say, that's all not the real thing. The real thing is in your heart, it's in your head, it's spiritual. So there was kind of a over correction that said, we're not going to be, we want plain, simple meeting halls, and we want to strip away that kind of artistic. You're gilding the lily. The truth of the gospel is sufficient. So then another thing he said is that his words, he says, the moral discriminator of the evangelical community is so ill-tuned that it reacts against and casts out of the church nearly any creative expression which depicts life as freely as the Bible does.
Yeah. That's a huge point.
Now, we've kind of hinted at that already,
but
if we really read the Bible, you've got the book of Job. There's tons of stuff there. It's not all easy to understand. The ending is clear, but all through a lot of the counsel that he's getting, you're not always sure what's right and what's wrong, and he's suffering. And
not to touch on a too touchy of a subject, but like, obviously, we don't want to endorse the kind of explicitness of Hollywood, of the Hollywood culture in the way they depict sex, right?
Right.
But there's also a sense in which the Bible talks about sex. It has a vision of what sex is about and what it's for.
Right.
And Not that we should be having, you know, graphic sex scenes in our Christian movies. That's the last thing I would.
As long as they're married,
right?
No. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But we should be able to discuss that topic in our visual arts and in our music because that's part of life, and the Bible discusses it.
Right. And absolutely right. I mean, I do think we have become encultured and accepting a level of immodesty that would probably scandalize our Christian forefathers.
Yeah, I think so.
I don't see that we are going to quickly turn that back without causing more damage than good.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
That's a challenge.
That's a challenge.
But the reality, like you said, both sex and violence are very, very present in the Bible.
Yes. Yeah.
And the Bible is not prudish in talking about things.
No.
I got into trouble legitimately. It was my fault. But in the beginning of when we were having COVID and we were first starting to live stream, I was so used to the young children in our church being dismissed and going back into their children's program.
Hmm.
And I'm more concerned with young adults in our church hearing me addressing issues with a little bit of an edgy reality.
Yeah.
You know, that I had started preaching through Genesis and I didn't make the connection in my head that we had gone to live streaming. And so we were basically telling parents, Sunday morning, get your kids up, have breakfast, gather in the room, watch our live stream on your big screen TV. And so I went into a sermon from Genesis, and I was talking about how after the fall, within the first few chapters of Genesis, you have all kinds of moral evil happening.
Yeah.
There's rape, there's incest, and there's homosexuality. And, I mean, I heard from parents that they were rushing their kids upstairs, rushing their kids out of the room, having to answer awkward questions. You know, what's incest, mommy? Because I didn't realize that they were in the room
Right.
So I actually had several, you know, challenging conversations where I was happy to just admit that that was an oversight on my part and I would do better. But the interesting thing is, all I was doing was telling the story of the Bible.
Yeah.
Even though it was insensitive to the fact that little children were in the room.
Yeah.
And I hadn't given the parents any indication that this would be the theme.
Yeah.
It is all there.
Yeah.
All that's there.
I think that was the hardest, coming back to my story growing up, I think that was the hardest part about watching some of these, you know, quote-unquote Christian expressions or even Christian music is that they often presented a world that I didn't even see.
Mm.
I read the Bible and I go, yeah, the world's like this.
Yeah.
The world is like this, right? I watch a Christian film, quote-unquote Christian film, and oftentimes I go, this is not the world I live in.
Yeah.
And then it's hard to resonate with.
Yeah.
And then you're not even encouraged. You're actually kind of saddened afterward, right?
Yeah.
And so
I agree.
You know, when we think about art and we think about our music, we think about our films, we think about our paintings, you know, God died and came to this world, to this tragic world.
Right.
And he's turning it into an ultimately incredible, it is an incredible story and it's becoming an incredible story.
Right.
Right. And there's beauty there because the beauty is wrapped up in the mystery of how it's all going to turn out, of how the story is going to unfold.
Yeah.
We don't know, but we know it's going to turn out really, really well, right? And so I encourage our listeners to really look for art that has that hope of restoration, but also knows how to acknowledge the continuing tragedy that it is to be in this world.
Yeah.
And that's, and again, those two statements sound like they're contradictory, but they actually go together, right? There's a beautiful book about art by Friedrich Buchner, who is a Presbyterian minister in the 70s.
Yeah.
He wrote a book called Telling the Truth, The Gospel as Tragedy, Comedy, and Fairy Tale. It's a beautiful little book. I'd really recommend it. And it's just about genre, and genre in terms of the different just competing realities of the world. We live in a world that's tragic, but we also live in a world that God is making all things new. Mm-hmm. And so therefore there's a classically comic, you know, comic as in a good story, a good ending to the story, a comic dimension to the world and to God's story. It was just, it's really cool. I'd recommend the book.
Well, one of the things, we probably should move towards wrapping it up. It's a fascinating chapter. I encourage people to get the book, to read the book, to read this chapter. One of the things he says that kind of relates to that is a key factor when we're assessing the social moral impact of sex and violence in the media, and I think we're saying going to include that in music, movie, film, whatever, is the moral and theological point of view underlying a particular presentation and the reason those elements have been used.
Yeah.
So what you were saying about hope. Now, it can be that a piece of art can end with some ambiguity, but I would think even there, a Christian artist will have in their body of work some expression of this theme of hope as well. I know sometimes even with sermons, you know, I don't think like every sermon has to say everything, because I hope and I plan and I work to have a body of sermons in which sometimes different themes may be in the forefront, but the major themes are continually circling through.
But let's look at our at the Bible. Like we have apostles that were murdered and persecuted and martyred, right?
Yep.
And yet they had tremendous hope.
Yeah.
It looked like their stories ended in tragedy, but in reality, their stories were not just good stories. They were used so incredibly by God's kingdom, and as are all those who are in Christ.
Wow.
And so I just don't see this tension between a tragic story that looks tragic.
Yeah.
But that also, at the same time, you can write in themes of goodness and of virtue.
Which is what you just did.
Yeah.
Well, as we wrap this up, let's just point people towards a few resources. Hmm. We've mentioned Terrence Malick. Hmm. What are some of the other movies he wrote, he's done, besides Tree of Life, that you would recommend to people to say, watch this movie?
I think the other big one that's really the most forwardly Christian thinking is A Hidden Life.
A Hidden Life is great.
Yeah, it's beautiful.
And it's based on a true story,
yeah.
but it's artistically done. And it's probably a little more accessible than Tree of Life.
Yeah.
Because it has it's easier to follow the plot line
of
the story. And
linear.
There's more,
it's
more relational material all the time. So you can really relate to these characters.
Yeah.
But man, I would recommend both.
Yeah.
If you're a serious Christian who's serious about exploring the arts, I don't hesitate to say you should watch Tree of Life and A Hidden Life.
Yeah.
Lord of the Rings is great, but it's time to, you know, expose yourself to some other resources, your Christian filmmaking.
Yeah.
Okay. Then what about in term you mentioned Buchner?
Yeah.
Frederick Buchner. Are there any other books that you are ready to recommend at this stage or you know of?
There's a book that I'm reading right now called Faith Plus Art.
Faith Plus Art?
Yeah.
Who's that by?
I'm going to butcher his name. I think it's Mikado Fujimura.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
He's New York City.
Yeah.
He was connected with Tim Keller.
Yeah. And he's just writing a book about really a theology of creativity.
Okay.
And it's just really cool groundwork for any really hard thinking about making, just the idea of what does it mean to make something and make something in the light of God, of God's kingdom. Yeah. So really cool.
What do you think of Image Magazine?
I haven't read much of it. I know James K. Smith is the editor now.
Okay.
I've heard really good things. I got a friend in New York City who has been recommending it to it over and over and over to me to say, you got to read it. But I have not dived in yet.
Okay. So we're not 100% sure we can when I say we can recommend Image Magazine, all I mean by saying I'm not 100% sure is just we don't have any like firsthand in-depth.
No.
But I hear great things about it.
Yeah.
And James A.K. Smith is a serious guy, and this is a magazine that is devoted to Christianity and the arts. If you're out there and you're listening and you or someone you love, you know, maybe your son or daughter is really interested in the arts and visual arts and that kind of thing, and you wish you had some resources, you might. They have an online presence, and like I said, it's called Image Magazine. Check it out. Now, we were talking about some musicians that we kind of found them through the soundtracks of Terrence Malick movies.
Gosh,
and
what are some of those? So John Tavener is an English composer.
Okay. He's deceased now. He died.
And then Arvo Pärt is probably one of the most important composers of the last couple of decades. He's Eastern European.
He's from Estonia.
That's correct. Kind of neoclassical. I hesitate to use the word sacred music, but it's sacred. It's some of the most. And we actually use some of this music for our prelude music, actually.
Good.
During communion, we use one of his songs, Spiegel am Spiegel, which is a great song. That was actually one of the first times I came to the Christ community. And I was a huge fan of Arvo Pärt. And then I heard Arvo Pärt in the worship service, and it was awesome. And I had tears coming down my face.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah, it was just really cool.
We've got to curate some more of that quality of music for our those few times that we're doing that.
Yeah.
Well, friends, maybe those are just a few things that you could explore. I want to read something. You're pronouncing Arvo
Pärt.
Pärt.
Yeah, Pärt, yeah.
His name is spelled P-A-R-T, but there's the little double dots above the A. My wife this morning knew that we were going to have this conversation. My wife, Connie, is a fine arts major and a visual artist, and my son Adam is a visual artist, and my daughter-in-law Mel, Adam's wife, they're both visual artists with their master's degrees from University of Minnesota and the University of Oklahoma, and they're living out in New Haven, Connecticut, and doing art, and my wife does visual arts. It's been a huge part of their lives, and very much they're doing all their work out of a deeply Christian place. But anyway, she sent me this, something he said at the occasion of him receiving an honorary degree from St. Vladimir's Seminary in New York.
So he's
Orthodox.
Yeah.
So this is what he said. And we'll close with this and then wrap it up with an outro. He said, "Please allow some thoughts from my musical diary. This happened in the Pulista Monastery in Estonia. Have you thanked God for this failure already?" Those unexpected words were said by a little girl. I remember it exactly. It was July 25th, 1976. I was sitting in the monastery yard on a bench in the shadow of the bushes with my notebook. "What are you doing? What are you writing there?" the girl, who was around 10, asked me. "I'm trying to write music, but it's not turning out well," I said. And then the unexpected words from her, "Have you thanked God for this failure already?" The most sensitive musical instrument is the human soul, and the next is the human voice. One must purify the soul until it begins to sound. A composer is a musical instrument and at the same time a performer on that instrument. The instrument has to be in order to produce the sound. One must start with that, not the music. Through the music, God knits man in his mother's womb slowly and wisely. Art should be born in that similar way. To be like a beggar when it comes to writing music. Whatever, however, whenever God gives, we shouldn't grieve because of writing little and poorly, but because we pray little and poorly and lukewarmly and live in the wrong way. The criterion must be everywhere and only humility. Music is my friend, ever understanding, compassionate, forgiving. It is a comforter, the handkerchief for drying my tears of sadness, the source of my tears of joy, my liberation and my flight, but also a painful thorn in my flesh and soul, that which makes me sober and teaches humility. Thank you. Forgive me, please. So what struck me about this, you were just saying you came to church and you heard this man's music.
Yeah.
And when I read what's going on in his heart, it makes me want to hear his music.
Yeah.
Because there's something deep here that he, out of relationship with God, and, you know, as true Calvinists, we believe nothing is accidental. God's chosen and gifted this man, and this is part of his contribution to what God wants to do in the world.
Yeah.
So I would encourage you, those of you who are artists, to do your art. Even if nobody but God sees it, nobody ever buys it, if you can't make a living off it, just do it. And those of you who aren't artists, to maybe deepen your appreciation for allowing God to speak to you in ways that words alone can't, through music and literature and poetry and visual arts, and let it be a part of the fullness of the dance that's inspired by the music. Well, thanks for listening again. This is The Music and the Dance. If you like the podcast, please leave us a review, share it with some friends. If you have questions or input, you can email us. Maybe it's for me, maybe it's for Peter, maybe it's for both of us. Just email us at this address, ccc@cccdaytona.org. Thanks a bunch.